This is Audible.
Dreamscape presents Why We Swim by Bonnie Choi, narrated by Angie Kane. Survival. An old map from when this place was first settled shows monsters everywhere once the shore gives out. Carl Phillips, swimming. One night over dinner, my husband tells me a story he heard about a boat in the North Atlantic and a man who should have drowned. Late on the evening of March 11th, 1984, a fishing trawler was working on calm seas, 3 miles east of the island of Heimaey, part of an archipelago off the south coast of Iceland. The sky was clear, the air a wintry 28 degrees Fahrenheit. There were 5 crew aboard the vessel. Guthlaugur Frithorsen, the boat's mate, was just 22 years old. He had taken a break and was asleep below deck when he was woken up by the cook, who told him the trawling gear had snagged on the sea bottom. Soon after Frithorsen arrived on deck, he saw that the crew were trying to winch up the gear. One of the trawl wires was taut over the side, pulling the boat over so far that the sea had begun to wash through the railings. Frithorsen shouted a warning. The captain, Hjotur Jonsson, gave instructions to slacken the winch, but then it jammed. A swell ran under the boat, overturning it, and the sailors found themselves pitched into the freezing sea. 2 of the men drowned almost immediately, but the remaining 3, including Frithorsen, managed to grab hold of the boat's keel. The vessel quickly began to sink, and they could not release the emergency raft. In the 41-degree water, they would have less than half an hour before hypothermia claimed them. The 3 began to swim toward the shore. Within minutes, only 2 remained, Jonsson and Frithorsen. The 2 men called to one another as they swam, to spur each other on. Then Jonsson stopped responding. Frithorsen, wearing blue work pants, a red flannel shirt, and a thin sweater, kept swimming, and found himself talking to seagulls to stay awake. A boat came within 350 feet of him, and he shouted as loud as he could, but it sailed away. He swam backstroke, his eyes trained on the lighthouse at the southern end of the island. Eventually, he heard the surf crashing on the coast. He prayed he would not get obliterated on the rocks. He found himself up against the base of a steep cliff, exhausted and terribly thirsty, unable to feel any of his extremities. With no way to climb up, he turned back to the sea, adjusted course, and swam farther south, where he came ashore and made his way slowly across a spiky, snow-covered lava field over a mile into town, stopping to punch through an inch-thick layer of ice on a sheep cistern to get a drink of water. When he finally arrived in town, it seemed to him a splendid dream vision of life. He knocked on the door of the first home he saw with lights on. He was barefoot and covered in frost. Behind him was a trail of bloody footprints on the sidewalk leading up to the house. This is a true story. In the end, Frithorsen survived 6 hours in frigid seas and swam more than 3.5 miles to land. When he arrived at the hospital, doctors were unable to discern his pulse, and yet he showed no signs of hypothermia, only dehydration. Frithorsen's body, it turns out, resembled a seal's. Researchers later determined that he was insulated by 14 millimeters of fat, 2 or 3 times the normal human thickness, and more solid. This man was more marine mammal than terrestrial. He had a biological quirk that saved him. It kept him warm, buoyant, and able to keep swimming. Many called him a real-life Silky, that half-man, half-seal figure of Icelandic and Scottish lore. To me, he is a living reminder that we are not so far removed from the sea. As humans, we walk the earth. We are land creatures with an aquatic past. I'm drawn to stories like Frithorsen's, because I want to know what remains of that past today. In a way, all swimming stories, from the naiads of the Greek myth to the long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad, who swam from Cuba to Florida in 2013, are attempts to reacquaint our land-adapted selves with water. We humans are not natural-born swimmers, but we have figured out ways to reclaim abilities that existed before that land-sea split in our evolution hundreds of millions of years ago. Why do we swim, when evolution has shaped us to excel on land by running down prey until it drops from exhaustion? Of course, it has to do with survival. Somewhere along the way, swimming helped us get from one prehistoric lakeshore to another and escape predators of our own, to dive for that trove of bigger shellfish and get to new sources of food, to venture across oceans and settle new lands, to navigate all manner of aquatic perils, and see swimming as a source of joy, pleasure, achievement, to arrive at this day to talk about why we swim. This book is an investigation of what seduces us to water, despite its dangers, and why we come back to it again and again. It's clear to me that once we can swim for survival, swimming can be so much more. The act of swimming can be one of healing and health, a way to well-being. Swimming together can be a way to find community through a team, a club, or a shared beloved body of water. We have only to watch each other in water to know that it creates the space for play. If we get good enough at the thing, it can be an engine of competition, a way to test our mettle in the pool or open water. Swimming is about the mind, too. To find rhythm in the water is to discover a new way of being in the world, through flow. This is about our human relationship to water and how immersion can open our imaginations. More than 70% of the planet is covered by water. 40% of the global population lives less than 60 miles from the coast. This book is for swimmers and curious humans of every stripe and age, whether you are drawn to water for speed or distance or transcendence. This is for those who heed the siren call of the water. It's also for those of us who seek to understand ourselves, that lost, quiet state of just being. No technology, no beeps, dating back to our watery human origins. We choose to put ourselves in all kinds of waters. Oceans, lakes, rivers, streams, pools. We even have a romance with lifeguards, the custodians of those places. At the intersection of these things, my family story begins. And not just because my mother and father met in a swimming pool in Hong Kong. I learned to swim when I was 5 years old, for the simple reason that my parents didn't want me to drown. In the bath, in the neighbor's backyard pool, at the beach. As a kid at Jones Beach, New York, I spent a lot of time in the 4 feet of water at the scalloped, lacy edge of the Atlantic. I can picture the scene clearly. My brother and cousins and I bob up and down in the shallows, waiting for a wave to come and lift us off our feet. We use our arms as rudders to pilot us along the face of a wave as it breaks, depositing us at the foamy intersection where water meets sand. Get up, laugh, repeat. We are mesmerized by that heaving body of water. So is everybody else. On a hot day and on a holiday, 100,000 other people might be there at Jones Beach. Lifeguards sit sentinel at their elevated stations, policing the crowds from behind mirrored sunglasses. There's something primal about a day like that at the beach. It's all the animals heading to the watering hole. Water is a magnet for our teeming throng of humanity. I watch the ways people dip in and out. Some are just there to cool off, electrifying entry, quick exit. Some stay a while, floating and splashing and swimming. Always there are people who keep their distance and don't go in at all. But still they come, hypnotized by the pulse of the ocean, alive to the sound of the surf and the smell of the briny air. I felt the draw of liquid early on, that slide into lovely immersion, that spiraling weightlessness, that privileged access to a muted underworld. Entry was granted to me there at Jones Beach, where we passed the hours within shouting distance of our mom's blue-flowered beach towels. In between swims, we gave each other wedgies and buried ourselves in the sand. I liked how the ocean seemed to draw breath, lying placid one moment and rearing up the next, moving us in one rippling mass to and from the horizon. Once a big wave came and smacked me from behind. Surprise overturning, ass over tea kettle. Then a liquid green room clouded by sand. Me, swimming and swimming toward nothing. Which way is up? 4 feet isn't very much water, but it's deep enough to drown in. Time stretched. I wondered about the press of my burning lungs, wishing for air. Time restarted with an accidental kick to the head from my cousin swimming not 2 feet away. Gifted this reference point, I scrambled to the surface, my hair wrapped around my face like kelp. Embarrassed and gasping, I looked around. When I realized that no one had noticed I was in trouble, I pretended that I never was, and I turned right back into the sea. What could bring on this voluntary amnesia? What did I find so alluring about the water that I could forgive a murder attempt by the sea, and so quickly at that? Most every year, a handful of people drown at the beaches of Long Island. At the time, I was just a young swimmer, going back for more of the magic, the illusion of being native to an element that is not home to humans like me. What I experienced that day stayed with me. 3 decades later, I'm an adult who swims for pleasure and exercise nearly every day. And yet I wonder about the deeper, more primitive instincts that drive us. We are pulled to the paradox of water as a source of life and death, and we have figured out myriad ways to conduct ourselves in it. Not everybody is a swimmer, but everyone has a swimming story to tell. In the examination of this universal experience, and it is universal, whether you are fearful of the water or not, whether you love it or leave it, you will encounter it at some point in your life. We find ourselves flexing our survival muscles, achieving something quietly triumphant with our persistence in the medium. Together we are pool hopping, chasing oases, immersing ourselves in the search of the bait that pulls us into the depths. This is an exploration of a world. Let's go for a swim. We begin with a shellfish. 1. Stone Age Swimming. The abalone does not want to come off the rock. 15 feet underwater, I jab the metal abalone iron underneath the shell, between the mollusk's muscular foot and the boulder it's fastened to, hoping for the pop I've been promised. Nothing. I try again, my breath beginning to bubble out of my nose with the effort of swimming in place, fighting the currents that are pulling me to and fro. Still nothing. This abalone, evidently sensing my presence, has locked down tight. Once that happens, I am finding, it is nearly impossible to remove. Diving for abalone is an attractive but dangerous sport. In pursuit of the elusive mollusk, I've submerged myself in the waters of Salt Point State Park, along the solitary, switchbacked Sonoma coast, 2.5 hours north of San Francisco. The hazards are many. Cold water, rip currents, rocks, kelp tangles, heavy surf, sharks. Still, most every season, April through November, thousands of hopeful swimmers make their way to the Northern California coast to try their hand at abalone hunting. The wild red abalone is the biggest in the world and is found only on the west coast of North America. It's where I can play the role of prehistoric hunter, swimming down for my dinner, with zero experience. I hold a scuba certification, but over the years, all that gear has come to feel claustrophobic and encumbering when I'm in the water. Here on this part of the coast, scuba tanks are illegal, so abalone divers are armed with few tools beyond their breath-holding and swimming skills. The reality of this back-to-basics man-versus-nature pursuit is that every cove along this part of the coast, rangers say, is a gravesite. In 2015, 4 people died while abalone diving during the first 3 weeks of the season alone. It turns out that even experienced divers can't hold their breath for long. People who are used to wearing full tanks of air start to panic when confronted with this fact. In the murky water, it's tough to stay oriented. The swell will toss you against the rocks, then suck you out to sea. But still, I want to try. I learned to spot the abalone's rippling lip of black tissue, or mantle, against the side of a big, craggy escarpment. I struggled to dislodge one, then another. An ancient pea-sized part of my brain lights up with satisfaction when I jackknife down to the seafloor, eyes on the prize, and I finally hoist a 6-pound abalone out of the water. I need both hands to haul it up and both legs to propel me. I can feel the grin forming on my lips before my head even breaks the surface. I've never felt the urge to shoot a bird for breakfast or run down a deer for dinner. But the direct appeal of swimming for my lunch is clear from the moment I spy the shellfish. There is something I need to understand about the act of swimming for something more essential than exercise. In my backyard later that day, I clean, trim, and pound the meat tender. Yep, with a rock. Cook it up over a flame and feed my family of four a meal I've prepared entirely with my own hands and breath and body. We are divorced from our food sources. It is a recognized symptom of modern life. Swimming for resources allows me, for a moment, to resolve the disconnect. That evening, when I rinse my hands in the sink and watch the water drain away, I remember the rhythmic sluicing of seawater through the rocks along the shoreline and what it felt like to watch it all flow back toward the horizon. The first known record of swimming lies in the middle of a desert. Somewhere in Egypt, near the Libyan border, in the Sahara's remote and mountainous Gilfkabir Plateau, there are swimmers breaststroking up the walls of a cave. The Cave of Swimmers, discovered by the Hungarian explorer László Almasy in 1933, contains a trove of Neolithic paintings that depict people in a range of underwater poses. Archaeologists have dated the creation of the artwork as far back as 10,000 years ago. At the time of Almasy's discovery, the notion that the Sahara had not always been a desert was a radical idea. Theories of a climate change that could account for the shift from temperate environs to a barren, hyper-arid desert were so new that the editor of Almasy's 1934 book, The Unknown Sahara, reportedly felt compelled to insert footnotes stating disagreement. But the paintings convinced Almasy himself that water might have been a natural feature in the immediate vicinity of the cave, that the swimmers themselves were the painters, that a lake lapped their very toes as they worked. Where there is now a sea of sand, there was water flowing. Where one medium is liquid life, the other may seem to be its parched, granular antithesis, he thought. But the two were indeed connected. It turns out, of course, that Almasy was right. Decades later, archaeologists would find dried lake beds not far from the cave, from a time when the Sahara was green. His answer to the riddle of swimmers in the desert would eventually be confirmed with a remarkable abundance of geological evidence showing a landscape once dotted with ancient lakes, as well as the startling discovery of hippo bones and the remains of many other water-dwelling animals, including giant tortoises, fish, and clams. This wet period became known as the Green Sahara. Not long ago, in an old issue of National Geographic, I read about a paleontologist named Paul Serino who further confirmed Almasy's hunch. In the fall of 2000, Serino was hunting for dinosaur bones in a different part of the Sahara, the southern edge in conflict-prone, little-explored Niger. In the open desert, some 125 miles from the country's largest city, Agadez, one of his expedition photographers scrambled up a remote group of dunes and stumbled across a massive trove of skeletons. This time, the bones weren't from dinosaurs or hippos. These eroding, windswept sand dunes revealed what turned out to be hundreds of human remains, interspersed with prehistoric fragments of pottery that were up to 10,000 years old. Some of the pottery pieces were carved with wavy lines. Others were stippled with dots. The burial place, which the scientists called Gobero, the Tuareg tribal name for the area, was the largest and earliest Stone Age cemetery found to date. It turns out that the Green Sahara was exactly the sort of place where prehistoric human swimmers might exist. On a bitingly cold January afternoon, I meet Paul Serino at his fossil lab at the University of Chicago, where he has been a professor for more than 30 years. There isn't much scholarship specific to Stone Age swimming, so I want him to help me conjure up a picture of this prehistoric world. Serino doesn't swim much himself, but he has spent a lot of time thinking about the swimming abilities of both dinosaurs and people. He is one of the scientists whose research established Spinosaurus aegypticus as the first known swimming dinosaur. There's a dash of Indiana Jones to him. He has the leather jacket and the restless enthusiasm. And he was once voted one of People magazine's 50 most beautiful people. I ask Serino to reconstruct for me an ancient environment that was suitable for swimming. In the Green Sahara of 10,000 years ago, he says Gobero resembled a Daytona beach in the desert. A vast, interlinked system of shallow lakes, many of them about 10 feet deep, with sand spits that allowed humans to walk out on the water. Scientists have named the aquatic system Paleolake Gobero. One of its most critical geographic features was a fault on one side, which did two things. One, it dammed up deep groundwater, so there was always water there, even if it didn't rain for a long while. Two, when it did rain, or when the groundwater welled up, the fault cliff acted as a natural dam flanking the site, with periodic spills to regulate levels in the basin. The shallow aquatic system came and went, but it was stable enough that people lived along its shores for many thousands of years. The pristine burial site contained the remains of two distinct populations of humans, their occupation separated by a period of 1,000 years, during which the lake disappeared and the site was abandoned. This greening and drying of the Sahara, Serino says, was the largest climate change since the last ice age, about 12,000 years ago. There were immense middens of shucked clamshells, so many shells that Serino thinks the people of Gobero must have dived for clams as well as collected them from shore. And the evidence there suggests that this was not the only means of catching dinner. There were carved fish hooks and finely honed barbed harpoon tips made from the jawbones of crocodiles. Serino and his team even found four harpoons embedded in the lake bed itself. They likely had boats, Serino says, but we have no idea what the boats looked like or what they were made of. And with the harpoons way out in the middle of the lake bed, I'd guess that they probably swam with their boats too. Serino's team also discovered heavy, flat-bottom stones, what they suspect to be weights for netting fish like tilapia and catfish. In a lab workroom where researchers clean and prepare materials for display, he hands me one of these, a smooth, brown-speckled oval that has a pleasing heft. In that lake, the ancient fishermen speared and landed impressive catches of Nile perch, a freshwater monstrosity that can grow to 6 feet long and weigh more than 400 pounds. The species, though in decline today, is still an important food source in many parts of Africa. A lot of things surprise me as I poke about the lab of this famous paleontologist. Serino is pretty blithe about the test tubes of invaluable early human DNA bagged up and sitting on his desk, still waiting to be sent out for analysis, and about the half-prepped new dinosaur species in his cabinet, still waiting to be named. If you have a roaming curiosity that refuses to settle long enough to get hung up on paperwork, I suppose you'd leave those things laying around too. Have you ever seen a dinosaur mummy? I love mummies. He exclaims as he invites me to examine a rare dinosaur fossil that reveals the specimen's textured hide. I run my fingers lightly over the imprint's bumps and ridges. The first thing that comes to my mind is dinosaur leather, and I can't stop myself from blurting it out loud. Serino allows me to handle everything in the lab, from sharp arrowheads and fragile pottery to a plate from a stegosaurus and even the remnants of a T-Rex. This physical proximity to the past, paired with Serino's enthusiastic, mile-a-minute commentary, is nothing short of spellbinding. A little side trip to prehistoric times. But with all the evidence, We still can't tell how well the people of Paleo Lake Gobero swam. The frustrating thing about investigating the trail of humans' aquatic past is that a wake doesn't stick around. What Serino and his researchers can show is that these inhabitants of the Green Sahara led a hunter-gatherer existence, pool hopping as needed, but mostly staying put by the water. I like to imagine that these early humans dove for their towers of clams in the way I dove for abalone, with some kicking and bobbing and gasping, yes, but also with a measure of wonder and joy. It's not so hard to picture how that might have happened. I think about my own sons, who are no happier than when it's low tide in Bolinas, a little coastal hamlet an hour north of where we live in Berkeley, California. In the mornings, there's often a low fog hanging over the silvery lagoon. The boys race around on the muddy flats revealed by the receding tide, leaping over darkly sandy rivulets. They dart to and from the edge of a restless ocean. They throw seaweed at each other. They build pyramids of sand, jabbering a detailed backstory to go with the miniature complex they have constructed, before they inundate the whole thing with a mass flood. I watch as they dance in and out of the water, continually testing their comfort with the depths. They both love the sea. Felix, the older, has known how to swim for some time, but Teddy, the younger, is still shy around water that moves of its own accord. Perhaps it happened the same way, so many thousands of years ago. A girl gathers clams at the edge of a paleo lake. It's been her job as long as she can remember. She can see the clams just beyond the drop-off to deeper waters. Maybe those clams are bigger than the ones she can reach just by waiting. One day, she wonders if she could hold her breath to get to them. Little by little, she ventures out and back, pushing off the sandy bottom with her toes, bobbing at the surface, frog-kicking her legs to free her face from the water. Weeks go by, maybe months. The bobbing and gasping eventually give way to something she can sustain. She knows what it is to float untroubled, conserving energy, and what it is to scissor her body and swoop down when she spies a promising mollusk. She finds success in unearthing a new cache of food. Others start to imitate her up-down method. There is a magic to being able to look at tangible objects from a bygone era, to say, "See here, they were here, where we stand, right now." To point at a curved arm bracelet made of hippo ivory and say, "She wore this." To pick up the jagged tip of a spear and picture those water hunters diving and digging and swimming, paleo man, just like us. These early humans were agile enough to avoid hippos and crocodiles that shared the water with them. And they would have had time enough to master swimming, because they weren't scouring the landscape in search of water or food. The lake, and the animal riches contained therein, made it possible for these societies to thrive for millennia right on its shores. Elsewhere in the Green Sahara, during this same wet period, perhaps those cave painters were swimming too. Though the earliest evidence of human swimming dates back just 10,000 years, we most likely knew how to swim much earlier than that. Our modern human species, Homo sapiens, began to evolve nearly 200,000 years ago from other species of now extinct ancestral humans. There is evidence of those ancestral humans going to sea too. In 2008, on the Greek island of Crete, a team of researchers found quartz-stoned hand axes that were hundreds of thousands of years old, embedded in rock terraces near cave shelters on the southern coast. The rough tools were unlike any others previously found there and resembled those used by Homo erectus, a species of ancestral human found in Africa and mainland Europe. Because Crete has been separated from the mainland for 5 million years, those ancestral humans would have had to travel to the island by open water. It was proof of Mediterranean seafaring peoples tens of thousands of years earlier than scientists had previously thought. Open ocean voyages are pretty hard to pull off if you don't know how to swim, or if you don't have comfort and familiarity with the water. Even Neanderthals, extinct close relatives of humans, may have swum for their food. I consult the British anthropologist Chris Stringer, who studies Neanderthals and is an expert on human origins at London's Natural History Museum. His team's findings from caves in Gibraltar showed that late surviving Neanderthals, who overlapped with modern humans, lived off the sea about 28,000 years ago, before they died out. The Neanderthals collected mussels from a river estuary and butchered seals and dolphins, dragging them into caves for food prep by the fire. How did Neanderthals catch those fish and dolphins and seals? We can't tell if or how they swam. But the distribution of the marine animal remains in the cave strata shows that Neanderthals had long-time knowledge and familiarity with coastal resources, a behavior that has rarely been found before modern humans came along. But if diving for abalone taught me anything, it is how easy the act of swimming can seem, and how imperceptible the dangers can be. Serino tells me that the most striking discovery at Gobero actually has to do with swimming and drowning. A moving triple burial at the edge of the Paleo Lake that his team dubbed the Stone Age Embrace. He describes what it was like to uncover the three bodies. A 30-year-old woman and two small children, aged 5 and 8, lying intimately together with hands intertwined. It was a spectacular burial, three crania coming to the surface, he says, recalling the delicate unearthing of the skulls. The team moved carefully during the excavation, which was difficult to perform. Loose sand moves like water. Every time you brush it away, it trickles back. The poignancy of the pose, arms stretched to the other, holding hands, affected everyone in the expedition. The arrangement seemed clearly ceremonial, Serino says. A sample of sand taken at the scene later showed that flowers, a species in a genus called Celosia, a part of the amaranth family that can come in many colors, had been laid down. Arrowheads carved from petrified wood were found underneath the bodies. They were x-rayed and scanned with an electron microscope. The analysis showed that they were never fired and were probably deliberately placed there for symbolic purposes. When examined, the skeletons and teeth revealed no stress patterns of injury or disease. Serino asks me if I'd like to meet the people of Gobero. Right now. He leads me to the excavated display of the triple burial, pointing out the arrowheads, the healthy teeth, the deliberate placement of the bodies. Though being in the presence of so many tangible paleontological finds, the dinosaurs, the other ancient aquatic animals, was profound, I found the encounter with the human remains to be even more so. I realized that it's the story embedded in the earth with them that captivates me most. The Stone Age Embrace is at heart a story familiar to you and me. The three, a mother and her children, died together, suddenly, drowning, and someone, a loving husband and father, had time to perform an elaborate burial ritual. Serino confirms at least some of my imaginings. When can you pose a body? You have to contend with rigor mortis and rotting in the sun, he explains. So it was a sudden death somehow. On water's edge, I think it was the result of drowning in Paleo Lake Gobero. It is a timeless tale of a parent's worst nightmare. I know what it is to be that child on the beach, playing and exploring. And I know now what it is like to be a parent, watching my two young sons learn to swim and experiment by the water. Then, as now, the states of swimming and drowning are terrifyingly, thrillingly porous. It remains that way no matter how well we have mastered the skill. Wet periods punctuated by long, dry ones also allowed pieces of that past to persist to this day, for us to find. Collapsed into the tragedy of the triple burial is the beginning of everything. Another timeless tale, of course, is that of a drowned world. A cyclical variation in Earth's orbit brought Africa's seasonal monsoons north and made the Green Sahara possible. Gobero is an unparalleled record of the humans who lived there. The remnants of these lives have special resonance for us today. When waters are rising higher and temperatures are fluctuating above and beyond what we have ever recorded, We ourselves may soon be devastated by water. And this time, our own activities are the cause of dramatic changes to the surface of the planet. By 2030, the number of people affected by floods is expected to triple. In California, where I live, sea level rise could exceed 9 feet by the turn of the next century, washing away more than 50% of the beaches of the Golden State. Worldwide, sea level rise has the potential to turn hundreds of millions of people into refugees. 2. You're a land animal. Most land mammals possess instinctive swimming ability from birth, but humans do not. Elephants, dogs, cats, albeit reluctantly, and even bats can swim, and pretty well, too. Humans and other large primates, like chimpanzees, have to be taught. Some scientists speculate that this has to do with the way the anatomy of the great apes evolved to be better suited to swinging through trees. In the rare experimental cases in which apes were taught to swim by researchers, they exhibited a frog-like kick instead of the doggy paddle so common in other mammals. "You evolved from fish," Paul Serino tells me. "But now you're a land animal trying to swim. You're what we call a secondary swimmer." Don't be too disappointed just yet. The paleobiologist Neil Shubin explains that the structure of the human body is the legacy of ancient fish, reptiles, and other primates. In a 2014 documentary based on his book, Your Inner Fish, Shubin says that being a fish paleontologist is a very powerful way to teach human anatomy, because often some of the best roadmaps to our own bodies are seen in other creatures. The fish's legacy, their fins, our limbs, all start from the same group of cells. Within us, there are intriguing traces of a swimming past. And if we hold in our bodies the ghosts of other animals, it follows that hints of certain functions remain and reawaken with submersion. If you put a 2-month-old face down in water, the baby will hold her breath for several seconds and her heart rate will slow, conserving oxygen. But that doesn't mean she'll swim to safety if you throw her in a pool. As babies get older and their neurological systems develop, that bradycardic reflex, part of a whole suite of primitive or residual reflexes that include sucking and grasping, starts to weaken. Humans, though, are imitation machines. We learn through observation. Everything from movement patterns to reading the emotions of people we encounter, in domains ranging from tool making and food preferences to ideas about fairness, mating, and language. The key to understanding how humans evolved and why we are so different from other animals is to recognize that we are a cultural species, writes the evolutionary biologist Joseph Henrich, whose influential work centers on how cultural and genetic evolution interact. Cumulative social learning, our ability to form large-scale collective brains, as Henrich calls it, is particular to us. Other animals exhibit social learning, but humans are singular in doing it on a cumulative cultural level that actually influences genetic evolution. Henrich illustrates his theory with case studies from his cheekily named Lost European Explorer Files. When European explorers got marooned in some new, seemingly inhospitable environment, the Arctic, say, or Australia, they invariably died of starvation, sickness, or exposure, except in the cases when they fell in with local indigenous peoples. Those locals were robust and healthy. They knew how to thrive in the so-called harsh environment, and had for millennia. Human groups connect and build bodies of knowledge that no single individual is smart enough to figure out in one lifetime. How to make a triple-barbed fishing spear, what to burn for fire in the absence of wood, how to leach poisons out of a toxic plant to make it edible. Paleoarchaeological records indicate that this kind of cultural evolution has been happening for at least the last 280,000 years, and that it rapidly accelerated over the last 10,000 of those. This culture gene coevolution helps explain the outstanding evolutionary success our species has had on our planet. Individually, we aren't all that special or smart, but our ability to acquire, store, organize, and pass on an ever-growing body of information over generations makes us smarter than any one person or group. The practice of swimming, and the different ways in which we teach ourselves to swim, is part of that collective cultural knowledge. When it comes to swimming, it is not just the how-to, the formal instruction, that is critical, but also the ways we communicate the importance of that knowledge through the stories we tell. A brief history of what we have come up with to aid us in swimming over the last two millennia or so. Approximately 400 BC, Rome. A cork life jacket. Described by Plutarch and worn by a messenger sent by the Roman general Camillus to swim the Tiber because the bridge was in the possession of the Gauls. 14th century Persia. The translucent outer layer of a tortoiseshell to protect the eyes while diving for pearls. 15th century Italy. A bladder constructed of animal skin and blown full of air for breathing underwater, designed by Leonardo da Vinci, who also made sketches for swim fins, a snorkel, and other buoyancy devices. Date unknown. Japan. A rope line attached to a pulley used by the Ama, Japanese freediving fisherwomen, to reel themselves up from the depths in case of swimming or breathing troubles. 1702. Boston. Swim paddles in the shape of oval painter's palettes to wear on the hands, from inventor and expert waterman Benjamin Franklin, to go faster. 1896. Elsewhere in Massachusetts. A metal-framed swimming machine to hold a student safely in the water, with mechanical arm and leg supports that moved the body in the appropriate stroke and kick motion, patented by James Emerson. 1908. London. A set of water wings sewn from fine cotton material, with valves for inflation. Tens of thousands were sold to the public under the brand Swim Easy Buoy. 1930. Miami. A wooden swimming costume fashioned from thin strips of spruce. A novelty to encourage and keep timid female swimmers afloat. 2017. China. A tiny handheld device with double propellers, the White Shark Mix, promises to help any beginner swim like a champion and become an uncontested star in the water. Sometimes we need a little help. If the complement to human biology is culture, then our strength is our ability to identify a problem and invent the solution. The names of these inventions and their descriptions are for me a kind of aquatic poetry. It is the sound of our imaginations dancing with our biology to make the impossible possible. 3. Lessons from a Sea Nomad. In the coastal regions of Southeast Asia's Coral Triangle, we get a glimpse of swimming lessons in a vanishing aquatic society. The best freediving fishermen can swim down to 200 feet and stay there, alternately swimming and walking along the ocean floor. Humans are negatively buoyant at that depth, spear guns in hand for 10 minutes at a time until they find their prey. They can spend 5 hours a day submerged underwater. For thousands of years, in what is today Malaysia, Indonesia, and the Philippines, the youngest Bajau sea nomads have been initiated into a life of the sea before they even learn to walk. Parents pray that babies will be blessed with the aquatic abilities they need for a life joined with the reef. Even 2- and 3-year-olds can dive with ease, their legs flicking powerfully to propel them to collect small clams. From their families' houseboats, older children teach their younger siblings how to float and kick and look for fish. The Bajau have recently been shown to have spleens that are 50% larger than those of related groups of villagers on the Indonesian mainland. When we dive underwater, the spleen contracts as part of the mammalian diving reflex, shooting its supply of oxygenated red blood cells into circulation around the body. The heart rate slows, and blood vessels constrict, directing blood flow away from the extremities and toward major organs. These energy conservation measures kick in so we can use available oxygen more efficiently. Marine mammals, such as seals, who spend much of their lives underwater, have disproportionately large spleens compared with land-based mammals. Seals with the largest spleens can dive deepest. Think of it as having an extra tank of air. Research shows that the bajau's oversized spleens are due to natural selection, not to diving itself. Bajau people with genes that produce larger spleens tend to survive and have more offspring. Even bajau who have never been divers have the same trait. Their bodies have evolved to be better at freediving. Though this particular trait of the bajau is inherited, other aquatic characteristics are acquired. Similar freediving sea nomads, like the water-dwelling Moken, who also live on houseboats and coastal homes on stilts in communities throughout what is today Thailand and Myanmar, have a special ability to focus their eyes underwater. The Moken kids who grow up diving have been shown to have underwater vision that is twice as sharp as that of us landlubbers. Where the rest of us see a blur, these mer people can easily gather clams and sea cucumbers from the ocean floor without the aid of goggles or masks. Most of us see terribly underwater because of the refractive power of the curved cornea, which works so well on land, is offset by immersion in the water. Sea nomad kids are able to accommodate for that when they are underwater by constricting their pupils, which increases the fine detail of what they can see. At first, it wasn't clear whether this ability was inherited or learned, but researchers figured out that early immersion training can change all of us. In fewer than a dozen visual practice sessions aimed at distinguishing specific kinds of contrasting patterns underwater, non-sea nomad kids were able to achieve a lasting heightened ability to focus underwater. The water has shaped these peoples in other ways, too. Survival in these places requires not just swimming skills, but also an understanding of how the aquatic environment works. These cultures take steps to prepare themselves. On December 26, 2004, when a massive tsunami in the Indian Ocean killed some 230,000 people along the coastlines of South and Southeast Asia, the Moken survived by reading signs in the water. On the remote Surin Islands off the coast of Thailand, Moken villagers fled toward higher ground after someone noticed the sea receding and the shore going dry. They warned everyone they saw and were gone long before the first wave hit. The village was decimated, but all of its residents were saved. In Mu Ko Surin National Park, some 24 Moken were out guiding tourists on snorkeling excursions when they recognized that the currents were moving strangely. They steered their boats away from the coast into deeper water and survived. A similar thing happened to a group of Moken fishermen out in Myanmar-governed waters. After observing fiercely swirling water around their vessels, they immediately headed further out to sea. Other fishermen in the vicinity were busy with the squid harvest. When the seas rose up with a terrific violence, they were tossed to their deaths. Elsewhere in the region, elephants stampeded for higher ground. Cicadas went silent. Dolphins swam toward the depths. None of these Moken had ever seen a tsunami themselves, but Moken elders spoke of the legend of the 7 roller waves, which come once every 2 generations. Laboon was the name they had for the biggest of the waves. It was a cleansing wave, one that arrived with a fury to consume and destroy. Similar stories of sudden saltwater floods and mass drownings exist in the oral tradition of First Nations and Native American tribes in the Pacific Northwest, and are confirmed by Japanese tsunami records dating back 1.5 millennia. Knowledge is encoded in these stories. Bajau legends about half-fish people and Moken stories about the 7 big waves are really stories about how to live a life at sea. Over thousands of years, without a written language, storytelling is how these peoples have successfully passed along the aquatic skills so key to their longevity and survival. Swimming, diving, fishing, boating, all of it made possible by keen observation and intimate knowledge of the marine environment. The stories teach reverence. Before diving, the bajau make an offering to the ocean spirits. A bit of food floated in a coconut husk boat. A cigarette in a leaf, a stick of incense. because the ocean spirits can be kind or cruel. They are mercurial, and with their mood goes the mood of the frothing seas. If you are humble before them, if you are gentle with the coral, if you are respectful of the fish and don't take more than you need, the ocean will take care of you. The last of these historically nomadic fishermen struggle today to adapt to a changing world, where, as stateless people with no citizenship, no documents, and few options for work, they are perceived by many governments as adrift in the worst sense. And yet, even as the Bajau and the Moken ways of life are eroding around them, fewer and fewer are able to continue a life of subsistence fishing. The last vestiges of their culture still tell them how to swim to survive. We are not amphibious, but I like the idea of amphibiousness. The naturalist Lauren Isley wrote that the great accomplishment of modern science was the ability to time travel, not just through the concrete observations of the world around us, reading seams of exposed strata, but also through our own imaginings. I saw the drifting cells of the early seas. The salt of those ancient seas is in our blood. Its lime is in our bones, he wrote. Every time we walk along a beach, some ancient urge disturbs us, so that we find ourselves shedding shoes and garments, or scavenging among seaweed and whitened timbers, like the homesick refugees of a long war. We are products of physical evolution, but we are driven by our interpretation of that evolutionary history. The awareness of rising seas is being built into many modern-day societies living waterside, like the Dutch. The swimming lessons we can take from them involve actual swimming lessons. To earn the right to use public pools freely, all Dutch children take classes to get a diploma that certifies their ability to swim in their clothes and shoes. I am riveted by a striking underwater photo of fully clothed Dutch fifth graders in one of these swimming classes. It makes sense. They wear garments every day, don't they? And so if the water comes, they will be ready. It hits me that this kind of thinking is in alignment with the traditional adaptiveness of the sea nomads, that we should teach ourselves how to live with water, not how to keep it at bay. It's a basic part of our culture, like riding a bike. The Dutch architect Rem Koolhaas once told the New York Times, "Everything is constructed and conducted with an awareness of the possibility of flood. A national water management center controls the day-to-day flow of water in and out of the Netherlands." The mayor of Rotterdam, Ahmed Abu Taleb, explains that his city lies in the most vulnerable part of the country. In the case of a flood coming in and overpowering the system they have created, from the rivers or the sea, we can evacuate maybe 15 out of 100 people, he said. We have no choice. We must learn to live with water. We must learn to live with water, and then it opens us up to possibility. We first swim to survive the water. We can't view swimming as anything else until that happens. But once we can survive it, the water can be something more for us. We can live with it, thrive with it. I think of Charles Tomlinson's poem, Swimming Shenango Lake, which captures the state of being. He describes swimming as the act of moving in the embrace of water, but mindfully. To do so is to realize what it means to be, as Tomlinson writes, between grasp and grasping, free. 4. The Human Seal. Guthlaugur Frithorsen learned to swim as a boy in a public swimming pool in 1960s Iceland. His island, Heimai, it means home island, is the largest of the Vestmannaeyjar, or Westman Islands, and its only inhabited place. In the first of three photos he shows me from that time, kids frolic with white foam kickboards, yet another ingenious swimming invention, under the watchful supervision of an instructor stationed at the edge of the pool. In the background, behind the pool's high-walled perimeter, you can see the craggy volcanic island topography in which the town, also called Vestmannaeyjar, sits. In the second photo, Puffs of ominous black smoke hover above the cool blue rectangle of the pool and its neighboring red-roofed white buildings. In the final photo, taken during the volcanic eruption of 1973, there is an incandescent river of lava flowing through town. In the end, the community of 5,000 people was evacuated by the island's fishing fleet, and this part of Guðlaugr's hometown, including his old pool, fell victim to the lava. In Iceland, people are known and addressed by their first names, the surname being simply whose son or daughter you are, a convention I will apply throughout this chapter. A new swimming hall, built with donations after the eruption, would feature a series of pools heated with the resulting geothermal energy. The 1973 eruption is notable because Iceland decided to fight the lava, to halt the fiery flow with massive hoses pumping cold seawater to save the harbor. Heimaey is one of the most important fishing centers in Iceland, with a critical harbor situated along the south coast. Today, its fishing boats still account for about 15% of the country's fish catch by volume. Though lava engulfed much of the town, it actually improved the harbor upon which the island and Iceland itself depends, narrowing its mouth and making it more protected from rough weather. It gave Heimaey millions of tons of ash for paving the streets, geothermal heat that warmed the town's buildings for a decade, and a new conical volcano to go with the one the island already had. It also increased the size of the island by 20%, creating steep new cliffs over 100 feet high. Near the base of these inhospitable, wave-battered cliffs on the east side of the island is the place where Guðlaugr came ashore in the wee hours of March 12, 1984. Guðlaugr himself is viewed as emblematic of the national character of Iceland. The writer John McPhee immortalized the people of Iceland in The New Yorker thusly: "No matter how overwhelming a situation might seem to be, if there was any possibility of fighting back, they had done so. And this seemed to have produced evolutionary effects, expressed in the battle against the lava and much confirmed in the following story." The story that McPhee went on to tell, as you might guess, is Guðlaugr's. Note the language: evolutionary effects. It's a way to say that Icelanders are a people apart, that they are extraordinary in their hardiness, that they claim Guðlaugr as exemplary of what they hold dear. It's a heavy load, being Iceland's epic symbol of survival and resilience. A friend who works in the fishing industry tells me that his Icelandic colleagues vividly remember the day, in 1984, when Guðlaugr's fishing vessel went down. People make pilgrimages to see where Guðlaugr hit land, where he had to turn back into the water to swim to a place where he could climb across the razor-sharp lava fields into town. At times, he had to crawl on all fours. The basin he drank from so desperately is still there, marked in multiple languages. How much of his story is still remembered by Icelanders? All of it, they say. For a people living on a speck of land in the sea, Guðlaugr is heroic because, well, he reminds them of heroic tales. In an Icelandic saga dating back to the year 1300, there is an outlaw, Gerður the Strong, who swam 7 kilometers from the island of Drangey to the mainland. When he arrived, he warmed himself in a hot pool that is still there. Icelandic history is a ledger of lives lost at sea, sometimes just a few yards offshore. Heimaey's longtime importance as a fishing port means that its tiny population has disproportionately weathered the blow. An entire wall of Vestmannaeyjar's history museum is given over to records, dating back to the year 1251, of drowning incidents off the island's coast. As a result, the island has been a pioneer in swimming education and in the development of boat safety equipment, rubber life rafts, safety belts, rescue suits. Swimming lessons became routine in Vestmannaeyjar's harbor in 1891 and were held there until the town's first pool was built in 1934. In 1943, swimming instruction was made mandatory in all of Iceland's schools. For Vestmannaeyjar, the year 2003 was distinctive because no one drowned. Guðlaugr survived his ordeal for two critical reasons: because he occupies the body that he does, and because he is a good swimmer. One or the other alone would not have sufficed. In the annals of extraordinary real-life swims, Guðlaugur's is special. To me, his story is a unique intertwining of human biology and culture. The scientific experimentation Guðlaugur later underwent with a team of Icelandic and British scientists, who determined his unusual ability to retain a nearly normal core body temperature in extreme cold water, contributing to our medical understanding of hypothermia, made him famous the world over. Even my mother-in-law, who at the time was an operating room nurse in Massachusetts, read about his case in a medical journal. Reporters called Guðlaugur the human seal. A few months after the accident, the international media had tracked him down while he was visiting with friends in the United States, and The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson called. He turned to his friends and told them it was time for him to go back to Iceland. For someone who is so mythic in Iceland, in this country of 330,000 people, there was a time when he was as famous as Björk. Guðlaugur is resolutely off the radar. Now in his mid-50s and married, he still lives on Heimaey. He has 2 daughters and 5 grandchildren. For a time, he returned to sea as a fisherman, but for many years now he has worked as an engineer at a large fish processing plant on the island. As a general rule, he no longer talks to journalists, deeply uncomfortable with the attention that the press has brought him over the past 3 decades. Our correspondence begins when I decide to write him a letter anyway. I send it via registered mail. Over 3 weeks, I track its progress across the Atlantic. A wing and a prayer, I think. One afternoon, I get the alert that the letter has arrived at its destination in Vestmannaeyjar. The next morning, in my inbox, I receive an email from Guðlaugur. In 2012, the Icelandic director, Baltasar Kormákur, who is best known internationally for big-budget action films starring the likes of Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington, made a movie about Guðlaugur. Baltasar himself was a teenager when Guðlaugur's fishing vessel capsized. But as it has for his fellow Icelanders, the memory looms large. Like everyone else in our small country, I felt for all the people of the Westman Islands who again had lost men at sea. But I was also fascinated by the news on the sole survivor. Baltasar told a British newspaper, "Who was this man? What was he made of?" Guðlaugur was unhappy with the renewed scrutiny that the film brought. He had finally begun to settle into a life out of the spotlight, but the movie yanked him back in. "Make the movie when I'm dead," he told the filmmakers when they approached him. "I appreciate his reticence and his resistance to fame. I also understand the global fascination. We are captivated by survival stories because we hope they will reveal something about human nature in extremis. Remember Robinson Crusoe, one of the most well-known of all survival tales. The author, Daniel Defoe, wrote of his interests in what emerges of one's character under duress. I am most entertained with those actions which give me a light into the nature of man." Guðlaugur is a man of few words, something that I gather from our email correspondence. But there are glimmers of insight in his letters that intrigue me in the manner that Defoe describes. "Swimming saves lives," Guðlaugur tells me. "There is freedom in that." And so I get on a flight to Iceland to meet him in person. On a cold, diamond-bright afternoon in March, I arrive in Heimaey on a tiny red-and-white propeller plane. On our approach, we fly through a low-lying sea mist. I peer out the window to watch the island's twin volcanic cones emerge, the dramatic, undulating landscape suddenly real and three-dimensional. From town, I can see the series of turquoise-blue buildings down in the harbor where Guðlaugur works, the mythic swimmer with whom I have been corresponding for a year, and whom I have been thinking about for much longer, is here, and he's a real guy who uses Facebook. Mythic swimmers, just like us. We make a date to meet the next evening after work. I've planned my visit for March, so I can attend what's called Guðlaugsund, or Guðlaugur's swim. In a tradition begun by the local navigation college, There is a 6-kilometer, 3.7-mile swimming event held in Guðlaugur's honor and for those lost at sea. Year in and year out, ever since the first anniversary of the accident, the citizens of Vestmannaeyjar have faithfully carried out Guðlaugsund. In the first 2 decades of the swim, Guðlaugur was present to hand out the results, to help publicize the need for self-deploying life rafts among the Icelandic fishing fleet. Now I head over to the Vestmannaeyjar swimming hall, the one built after the lava flowed over the old pool. On this blustery, snowy morning, the island's famous winter winds are howling. Some of the highest wind speeds in Europe have been recorded on the southern end of Heimaey. I learned something of Iceland's deep swimming culture from Guðlaugur's loquacious opposite, Alan Allison, who is now one of the 2 organizers in charge of Guðlaugsund. Alan has worked at the Vestmannaeyjar swimming hall for 20 years as a lifeguard and pool manager. Before arriving on Heimaey, I spent much of the previous week visiting public pools on the Icelandic mainland. What I came to understand from the experience is that even in winter, no, especially in winter, everybody is in the pool. Iceland is one of the world's leaders in swimming pools per capita. There's a special Icelandic road sign for it, a head